Accession number 27185, reel 36.
Arras, reel 36. You're describing the arrangements made for the tattoo.
Yeah. We had to make up, we had to use talent that we had. And I think there were about anything up to about 20 turns. And now we're into October, the monsoon was over and we're in a dry period. We were aiming at putting on, I think, 3 shows early in December, which gave us the whole of November and part of October to get the thing going. The turns, as I remember them, was the Sikh battalion did a drill display. The King's African Rifles came into it and did a song. We brought them in. The Welsh Regiment gave us some singing. The Karen Rifles came in and did something. Now, the Karens, of course, were very pro-British Christian tribe living up in the hills not far away. We rather left them to there was nothing we could do about it, left them to the fate of the dictatorship, which took over later.
I think they're still fighting a war of resistance.
They are, yes, up in the hills.
Up in their hills,
yeah.
Yes.
The Gurkhas, I remember, did a dance. Which was rather charming, actually, because half of them were dressed as women. And of course, being small and slim, they looked the part. And it was a very slow sort of, it wasn't a sort of mad sort of cookery thing. It was a very charming little dance they did. Must have been a tribal thing that they did at home. And then, of course, there was another unit I haven't mentioned, which was the King George V Armoured Car Regiment. Which was also part of the division, which was British officers. Well, all the Indian regiments had British officers, as far as I can tell. They had British officers and Indian troops and NCOs. And they did a drive with their armoured cars, I remember. But they were an incredible lot. They had horses which they'd kept.
As well as the armoured cars.
But the horses they just use for their own benefit. Because the relationship between the Indian, British officers and the Indians is entirely different between the relationship between us and our British soldiers. First of all, they had to learn the local dialect. It wasn't just Urdu, of course, was the basic language spoken, which everybody understood. In fact, when I first arrived there, Reese said to me, you better learn some Urdu. He said, it doesn't matter in which order you put the words, as long as you use it. And they were as mad as hell, this lot. They used to go off on their horses in the moonlight and rush across the country. Of course, the Indians loved it. The Saabs all going off on their horses. And, of course, the relationship was totally different. In fact, it's little known that when they had leave and so forth, the British officers would go to India and visit the families of the Indian soldiers, because it was very often the fight was father, son, grandfather, who had all come and been in the same regiment, and they were always very glad to give their sons to the regiment, because they knew they were going to get well looked after. So they'd rather looked upon the officers as a sort of a foster father away from home. And the relationship was very close, which I don't think people understood. I think they thought these people, Indians, soldiers, were all sort of marched down and made to join. Of course, they were all volunteers, and it was the biggest volunteer army in the world. So they did their turn. Then we had some Burmese school children from the local school who came and gave little songs. There were other turns which I'm afraid I can't remember, but we were lucky in that we managed to get hold of the Duke of Aosta's band.
Duke of Aosta's band.
Yes. Now that had been
that had been
captured in East Africa.
Yes.
In 1940.
They must have been caught at Amber Alagi at the end of the campaign in Ethiopia.
Yes, and they were captured, and they've been sort of been pushed around the world, giving concerts and so forth, and getting depressed when they found themselves further away from Italy, and getting elation when they found themselves moving towards Italy. But they were an excellent band. And they did a marching display, and then we used them as a sort of arena band and put them at the side so they produced the music for the dancing and the songs and whatnot. And the chap in charge was a chap we called Maestro, Italian, very sad looking chap who was obviously missing his pasta in Tuscany or wherever he lived. And he used to get up at the beginning of a tune and he'd wave his wand and start them off, and then he'd sit down with his back to them and sort of wait until they'd finished. he never did anything whilst they were playing.
Didn't conduct them.
No. He used to sit, there was a chair there, and he'd just sort of start them off like that. And as soon as he realised they were all on the way, he then put his baton down and sat in the seat with his back towards them, sort of hunched up. And then when they finished, he'd get up and start the next one. I don't think he did it all the time, some of the time, but quite often we'd find him sitting down there with his back to the band, playing merrily away. I suppose they knew what to do. They'd been doing it for so long. So we then started, of course, having rehearsals. And we got some searchlights from somewhere, but unfortunately we couldn't get the crews. I don't know, they were odd engineers, I suppose, and I don't know, they weren't available anymore. So we had to use our own soldiers from the British Brigade. And I very remember very clearly one evening we were down there testing out the lights, and Bruce was up on his little sort of control box, which was being built on the top of bamboo trunks with steps up to it and a little box up there with a roof on, and he had a loudspeaker, he had a microphone there with a loudspeaker out around the arena, and we had the lights on testing them. And when he was satisfied that everything was okay, he said in a rather pompous way, "Strike your arcs," you see. Well, I happened to be standing near one of these lights, and nothing happened, of course. There was a Welsh regiment crew on this particular light. And then a voice came out saying, "Strike your arcs again," and nothing happened. And then he sort of said, "Douse." Nothing happened again. I think this whole thing was going to his head, you're sort of using all these technical terms.
As the impresario.
Yes, that's right. He said, "Douse again." Still nothing happened. And I heard sort of mutterings from the Welsh line, "What do you mean, douse? What's he talking about?" See, this was going on. And all of a sudden he snapped and he said, "Put those bloody lights out," and the whole douse, and the whole place was plunged into darkness in a minute. That was an order everybody understood. He really lost his temper. It was the funniest thing I've seen for a long time. So anyway, as time went by, we got perfection, almost as perfection as we could. The whole thing was, we brought in the prisoners of war, of course, to help with the...
What did they have to do?
Well, digging around in the arena, which I believe is probably against the convention of some sort, Geneva Convention. But however, they gladly came, better than sitting around in there all muttering together about the emperor or whatever he'd done to them. So they came out and helped. And then the day came when we were going to give our first public display. And the idea was to bring in all the soldiers from the brigades around the countryside. And this was where I had to organise it. And they all came in by train, most of them, I think. Local ones probably came in by trucks, lorries. And we also invited a whole lot of local Burmese to come in and see. And we brought in the Japanese prisoner of war chaps as well, and seated them in the arena. They were quite happy. There wasn't any question of them absconding. There was nowhere for them to go. So anyway, everything went well. Everybody was getting seated and so forth. And then all of a sudden I realised that a train coming from somewhere hadn't arrived. So I went down to the Tongu station, this little tiny station there.
Where did the line go to?
Well, it went up to Mandalay, further on from there, and down to Rangoon, right the way through Burma. And I walked down, the station was pitch black, nobody there. I walked down the line, and first thing I did was fall straight into an inspection pit. So having climbed out of that, I promptly walked somewhere else and fell down another one. However, I didn't hurt myself and I climbed out of that one. Anyway, the train eventually steamed in, going slowly, and I found out that they'd run out of steam halfway there because there was no coal, you see, they were doing it by wood. So they found they'd run out of fuel. So everybody had to get out and go into the woods and hack down bamboo, get the fire going again. And eventually got there. They weren't too late, but they were holed up because of that. So we had, I think it was three displays, three nights, that made sure that everybody in the division saw it. I think we ran out of spectators after that. So that was that. Just trying to think of anything else which is of any of interest before we leave. Oh yes, I went on a short leave up into Kalor. Kalor was a hill station near Tongu, not too far away. It's 4,000 feet up, and we were allowed, I think we had a weekend up there or something. We didn't have proper leave, but there were some European houses up there again which were empty, which got beds in, but no bedding, so we took our bedrolls up up there. Lovely and cool. And two things I remember about this time was, first, I was downstairs in my room getting my bedroll ready, when all of a sudden all the springs on the beds started shaking, rattling all over the house. And the next thing I saw was like all the guys from upstairs came rushing down the stairs shouting out, "Earthquake!" So I didn't know anything about this, so I rushed outside as well, and we listened to the beds all rattling inside the house. Luckily it faded out and we went back again.
You were all right.
We were all right, and we didn't get any more shocks. The other thing is, we went off on a shooting safari, I suppose you call it, into the jungle.
What were you hunting?
Jungle fowl. Now, jungle fowl is nothing more than chickens, or really cockerels, but with rather resplendent feathers. I don't know where we got the guns from. There must have been, I suppose, 12 bores, and perhaps they were sort of available there. We went out into the jungle, and what you had to do was to sit still and listen for a cock-a-doodle-doo somewhere. When you heard that, you then stalked it. And unfortunately, when you got as far as where you'd heard the cock-a-doodle-doo, there was no chicken or fowl there. You heard cock-a-doodle-doo again, but about 200 or 300 yards further off down the other side. And we spent an hour or so chasing cock-a-doodle-doos, never seeing one. So we decided to go. We found a clearing there and sat down to munch our sandwiches. And then a guy appeared out of the jungle, wearing absolutely nothing except for decency. Dark-skinned, carrying a bow, with a small pouch hanging from his belt, which had little lead balls in. And the way he got his lunch was to get these balls on the bow and shoot them like arrows. I'd never seen it before. Nobody seemed to know where this guy came from. Nobody had ever heard of a tribe which looked like this. Anyway, he was very friendly. And somebody put up a beer bottle, and he had a go at that and smashed it to smithereens from about 100 yards. And then somebody stupidly offered him some money for some reason or other, and he didn't like that at all. He just stalked off with all the dignity you can with nothing on, back into the jungle. We never saw him again.
Did anyone know anything about
this chap? No, we questioned people, other people later, and I don't know, perhaps if we got hold of somebody who really knew, had an expert knowledge of what went on in Burmese jungle, we might have tracked it down. But the ordinary people didn't know. Can't say we went around asking people all over the place. So we had that short leave. And then early in the 1946, I'm right this time, I think, the January, early February, the 19 Div began to break up. Reese went, and a brigadier took over. Some of the Indian battalions went back to India. Bruce went as a GSO-1. His place was taken over by the chief signal officer there, Colonel Knox, Spotty Knox he was called. Nice chap. He come up from Europe like me. And great sense of humour. And he took over. And then from somewhere, I don't know how it came, I was offered the job of GSO 2 Ops at Burma Command.
What was going to happen to the division then? Was it
going to just breaking up
altogether?
It was breaking up. People gradually, it was being run down. I don't know how far the Gurkhas were on their way home. The only ones left at that time were the British, I think. Well, for the time I left in, I must have left in early February or late January, I think. This offer came through to for GSO 2 Ops at Burma Command, and I thought, that's fine, that's what I went to Staff College for. Mm-hmm. And before I moved down there, a very irate Colonel GS Intelligence from Singapore, Alsea, I think, because Alsea had moved down to Singapore by then, arrived in Tongu and was very, very angry with me. I must say, I've never had any senior officer ever dress me down in this sort of way. I mean, I may have got little rockets from time to time. But he was very angry that I wasn't going to stay in the intelligence. I had no intention of staying in intelligence. It just wasn't my thing, really.
Did you have any training in intelligence work?
Well, I had, yes, because I'd been battalion IO, I'd been brigade IO, now I was divisional IO. I'd been on IO courses, but I'd never actually done what you might call top-level intelligence.
What did he want you to do then?
Well, he hoped that I would stay in intelligence and go to do more intelligence, presumably, in Alsea headquarters or whatever. I think he actually had plans to get me down to Alsea headquarters, probably. And when he found that he'd been gazumped, he didn't like it. But I stuck to my guns because I really didn't feel that intelligence was really my field. Mm. It probably got very interesting the higher up you got. No doubt, there were very brainy people in it, but. I couldn't sit behind a desk too long anyway. I mean, even when I left the army and was doing civilian work, if I wanted to speak to somebody in another office, I never phoned them. I got up and went down to see them. So it wasn't really a good idea. Anyway, it's the only time in my life where I've ever had a senior officer being really angry with me. Anyway, he went off in high dudgeon and I went off happily singing my way down to Rangoon.
So you hadn't made any sort of commitment to work?
No, none at all. None at all, no. Mm. All I knew was that I'd been offered this job as GSO-2I in 19th Infantry Division, which, as far as I was concerned, was just another staff job.
And then you were offered the job at Burma Command in Ops, which is more suitable.
More to my liking, actually, yeah. So, this was February, so the monsoon hadn't struck yet. Because the monsoon came about the middle of May. We did meet one or two of local Europeans who had come back. I mean, there was a big firm called Steel Brothers or something, which used to get teak going. There were a lot of mines in Burma as well. And we used to talk to some of them, and the general impression I got from them was that the monsoon always broke at a certain time on a certain day, it's like 1 o'clock on the 15th of May. Any rain before that wasn't the monsoon at all, it was called mango showers.
Something different.
Something totally different, yes. So you had to wait for the 1 o'clock on the 15th of May. It usually came in the middle of May there. I went down to Judson's College, where the Burma Command was based. The general at that time, the GOC, was one General Briggs.
This is Harold Briggs.
I can't remember what his Christian name was.
Harold Briggs, he was later in Malaya, Director of Operations in Malaya.
When he was general, full general then?
Yes.
He commanded a corps during the war in 14th Army. I don't know which one. But he's Indian Army. Brigadier was BGS, whilst one called Duke, known as Bulger Duke. Because all these guys in earlier generations all had nicknames, which didn't seem to go down later. I don't know why. But, you know, Spotty Knox and Bulger Duke and so forth. And my GSO1, who was my boss, GSO1 Ops, was Jack Stone. Now, he was from a northern regiment, I think. I think he'd made his way up from the ranks and was a very clear-headed, excellent chap to work for. Nothing on the side, everything out in the open. And he'd come up from Europe as well, so we had something in common together because he'd fought in Europe. There was another G2 there, ops, there were two of us, Kit Harper, major of a light infantry, I think. I don't know which his regiment was, but he'd been there out there for some time and was due to go home very shortly. And when he went, they didn't replace him. I took over everything he'd been doing.
What did Burma Command consist of when you joined it?
You mean the way of divisions?
The forces within the commands during the
war. Well, we still had a fair amount of Indians still there. I mean, although the 19th Indian Division had been broken up, there's the 17th Indian Division, as far as I can remember, was still in Maktila, which was north of Tongu, and there was somebody else in Mandalay. Both African divisions were still there. The British 2nd Infantry Division was still there. And I think there were there were a whole lot of administrative troops and services and so forth. So there were very large garrisons scattered all over Burma still. The rundown was going very, very slowly indeed because of lack of shipping. I mean, ships, when war suddenly came to an end in Japan, I mean, I don't think anybody has said in sort of June or July in 1945, oh, well, the Japanese war is going to end in August, so we'll get our shipping straight, we'll dump that stuff there and get them all ready. Nothing happened. I mean, when the atomic bombs went off, everybody was surprised, as we were, because we'd never heard of it going to happen before. So shipping was all over the world, fully loaded, going to various destinations. So it all had to be reorganized, stuff dumped, people taken back to where they came from, or cargo taken off. Must have been a very complicated program. And then, of course, there were emergencies, there were priorities, and we weren't a priority, I don't think, because we're a long way away from everybody else. But they were all very well behaved. Now, we didn't have much trouble. I did hear that in the African division, one African had thrown a grenade through an order room window once. Whether he hurt anybody or not, I don't know. But otherwise, they were very good, I think. We never had too much trouble.
Was your headquarters an administrative one as well as an operational one?
Yes. Oh, yes, it was.
Dealing with everything.
It was dealing with everything, yeah. And we had messes, a lot of messes. I was in a mess, officer's mess, which was mixed. I mean, we had the Prevost chief there and others. And it was run by a British sergeant with Burmese staff. Who were excellent. But the food, of course, was compo still.
On ration packs still.
Yeah. And bread, we got bread, mm-hmm. But of course weevils had got in the flour. So when the bread came up, you got a slice of bread, the first thing you did was to pick the weevils out before you ate it. We didn't have any fridges or anything in those days. There was no air conditioning, of course, you just relied on fans. Mm-hmm. There were ice boxes, which the butter was in, and a lot of beer went in there as well, I think. And at night, when we went in at night, there was we had to have these pressure lights, lamps. There were no electricity or any of that sort, which went. And of course, it attracted all the maybugs, which used to bang themselves against the light and drop in his soup. And then, of course, they used to scatter all over the floor. And when you walked out, you crunched out of the mess on the top of them. And of course, they were called stink bugs as well, and made an awful smell. So that's one of the hazards of eating at that time, especially when the monsoon build up to the monsoon. They came in their droves.
Was there no possibility of local purchase of getting?
There may have been later, but at that stage there wasn't, because it was the civilians first, really. I mean, we knew we were going to get compo, but the Japanese hadn't long gone, of course, and it was a question of getting the local situation going. But one day there was talking of the mess, later there was a strike. There was one Aung San, who was the head of a lot of guerrillas who had been in the jungle during the Japanese occupation. We don't think he was much help to us and his boys. He was more waiting to biding his time to
take over.
Of course, his daughter is there now, Aung San Suu Kyi.
The lady.
The lady, yes. He called a strike just to flex his muscles, I think, for no other reason. And, of course, that involved all our mess servants. But they all turned up, and they'd taken off their sarongs and colourful headgear and put on uniform. And they came in through the gate, walked down the road as military, and came in. And even the head bearer had put a couple of stripes on his arm to show that he was in charge. And they were a charming lot. I mean, they were always so helpful, and they turned up, and they weren't going to be put off by a strike. And they're
right. I mean, how did you get on with the Burmese generally?
Oh, very well.
Contact with the civil population.
Yeah, well, quite often down in the town. We used to go down the town. I never felt any way endangered at all. We used to go off on our own. We were never armed. When the monsoon broke, one of the hazards, of course, they have a fun and games, there were buckets of water, coloured water, which they used to throw over everybody. And if you were, of course, you were a target if you went down there in the jeep, and you used to come back looking like a strawberry.
Multicoloured.
Yeah, raspberry ripple ice cream. And it was all in good fun. Everybody was roaring with laughter and joking. And they were a lovely lot. And they certainly don't deserve the lot that they've got now. I mean, there were the dacoits, and there were the so-called evil ones. But you get those in every country. But the average person, the average man in the street or woman in the street, were very, very helpful. They always smiled. They were gentle people. And I was so, so sorry when I heard what had happened to them and the way they were being treated by the police. Because the police in those days were under the British officers and well-trained. So we didn't have any of that sort of thing.
What sort of operation was Burma Command directing then at that time?
Well, there were only, from an operational point of view, there were operations to try and round up dacoits and stop them from behaving badly, which was, we used to dedicate most to brigades, but we gave them a sort of outline directive as to what was required, and then they would then get their soldiers out on the ground and do it. The other thing which, but I was involved in training, allocation of ranges, shooting ranges, field firing ranges, anything to do with general staff I got myself involved in. One of the big things we did was to drop rice to the Karens up in the hills, because they were starving up there, the food hadn't got through. And I had to organize this, and it was done by a free drop. Rice was put into a sack, half filled so it didn't burst on them, and then a sack outside, loaded onto DC-3 RAF Transport Command Dakotas, and then sent off with a Royal Indian Army Service Corps